On the way to the bursar's office, new orders in hand, Esme couldn't feel that this was real.
I still can't believe they gave me a ship. I'm only a lieutenant.
Who has commanded ships in battle? What do you want, as an engraved invitation? This is an engraved invitation.
Protocol. I don't know all the protocol for it.
The memory of that hasty and scrambled assumption of command on despite did not reassure her.
That's what fast tapes are for. What about uniforms?
Right. Bursar's office, then the tailor's.
Swainson and Triggett, officers' outfitters, all services, greeted the new captain of a patrol ship with suitably restrained delight. An entire team of fitters measured her from tip to toe, then had her move. Sit, stand, walk, raise and lower her arms. When the fitters had done with her, Esme handed over her list of decorations so they could be added to the finished uniforms. She was feeling more and more that she was in some fantasy world. She was suddenly back in fleet. She was to command a ship. She had just ordered a full set of uniforms from what had to be the most expensive tailors in the universe. It was as if she'd fallen into one of the tales in which the despised outcast sister is transformed into a beautiful princess by magical hands. She did notice that Ser Triggett passed the bill discreetly to her father, who scanned it closely before handing over his credit cube. That night, they all had dinner at the Thornbuckle townhouse. She, her father, Brun, Kate, and Kevil Mahoney, who was finally out of rehab with his new arm. After the meal, the talk turned to Familius' politics.
You young ladies will most likely not agree with me, but I see the Familius facing more and more trouble unless it reconstitutes its government on more rational lines.
That's what I keep saying. They need a constitution.
They need clear thinking. A bad constitution would not help.
But the first thing must be the mutiny. Without security, they won't have time to think clearly.
You are definitely my daughter, Esmea. Of course they must put down the mutiny first and repel any invaders. That's the job of the fleet. But while you are out there blowing up mutineers, someone here must be thinking clearly about the reasons for the assassinations and mutinies and other unrest that troubles the realm. Is that not so, Sir Mahoney?
Yes, of course, but I don't quite see how we're to do that. Bunny and I were working on it, but without Bunny's influence, I'm small potatoes and few in the hill, as the saying is. I wrote his coattails.
Or drove him with them. I know you influenced his thinking a lot.
Well, it became clear to me when I was a young man that something was stifling opportunity for talent of all kinds. It took me a long time to figure it out. You think with colony worlds opening all around, with hundreds of populated worlds all linked by trade and expanding almost visibly, that there'd be plenty of chance to rise.
Some worlds are more conservative. Look at the Crescents, for instance.
Yes, that's what my professor said. And there was a lot of scoffing of the, that's just what they're like, what do you expect, from senior men of law who were content that it should be so. But I had the advantage of my grandfather's library. He had a passion for old books. By the time I was in law school, he'd long retired. And nothing pleased him so much as arguing over history with me. And not just legal history. One thing he convinced me of is that any system which does not give ample opportunity for talent to displace unearned rank will in the end come to grief.
What do you mean by unearned rank?
What you have, for instance. Or for that matter, my son George. This is not to say you and others like you don't have talent. You do. But your talent is displayed, as it were, on velvet, like a precious jewel. Think of those women in the new text culture, Brun. Were they all stupid, lazy, incompetent?
No.
No. Every time society has given it a chance, it's been shown that an ordinary sampling of the population, including those considered inferior or hopeless, contains men and women of rare intelligence, wit, and ability. Just as ponds turn over their water yearly, revitalizing the pond's life, so a good stirring of the human pot brings new blood to the top, and we're all the better for it.
We had that happen in Altiplano. Our patrons thought their colonists were just stupid peasants, born and bred to be inferior and ruled by themselves. But we did quite well without our natural leaders.
And yet you have rich and poor, don't you?
Of course we do. But I like to think, with a smaller population and our educational system, we give the children of poor families more chance to show what they can do.
Boys, at least. And all the land brides are from wealthy families.
That's so. Our system is not perfect. But since we don't have rejuvenation, our young people know they will have a place in society at a reasonably young age.
Now there you've touched it. Even the old forms of rejuvenation, each pretty much limited to a single application because of side effects, widen the opportunity gap at the top end of society. Repeated rejuvenations made things worse, much worse. It would have been bad enough if it had been available only to the richest families, forcing youngsters like you to sit idly waiting for a chance to take responsibility in the family that never came. You, from your perspective, may not be able to see how much the education and lives of rich young people changed in the 10 years before you were born. But I did. And rich young people, kept out of the family business, can amuse themselves in all sorts of ways.
Then rejuvenation spread.
Yes. Take a professional man like myself, who has accumulated 40 years of experience in his field, and can return to a vigorous younger body. Why would he retire? Why would he take on a younger partner when he himself felt young again? It's like crystallization, spreading and freezing through society, making brittle what had been fluid.
But people want to live. That's natural.
Yes, it's natural. It's as natural as wanting to find the perfect love that lasts forever, or peace without disturbance. It's the old, natural infant desire to have what you want when you want it forever. Up to now, the human race has been blessed by having such wishes impossible to fulfill. Harsh as it seems, the young have been able to count on their elders aging and then dying, making room. All human societies have been built on that awareness that everyone dies.
So we have to figure out how to live if they don't.
Exactly. Much as I dislike the benignity, their chairman's comment on endless adolescence hit the target. We need a range of maturity. If we're going to live for hundreds of years, we need to be grown-ups, not perpetual children. We need opportunities for the young, a chance for them to mature as well. We need to do something to include more of the population, to tie it together.
Can it be done?
I don't know, but we have to try, or we'll have a bloodbath, with the young and hopeless attacking the old and rejuvenated directly. We already have foreign enemies who tell us, who are adamant, that our use of unrestricted rejuvenation frightens them so much they will assassinate our head of state and consider invasion.
The Tarakians talked about this a little. They said the free traders weren't as affected because they could always go somewhere else, but they saw a lot of unrest that made them uneasy.
We've got to get people like that into the government. As long as the only people with power are the rich, rejuvenated oldsters, something's going to blow. There are a lot more people, including intelligent, thoughtful, decent people, who aren't rich or able to get rejuvenation. The last time I went over this with Bunny, we noticed that there are more unrejuvenated young people with a right to seats in council than rejuvenated ones with seats. That might give us a wedge, for as long as that majority lasts. But we still have to go outside the old families. However much inconvenience and trouble it may take to widen the franchise, a revolution would be far, far worse.
The hours ran out like water down a drain. A restless night's sleep, the salon appointment, a day spent in final fitting of the new uniforms. The sight of herself in the cape and long skirt of the mess dress startled her. She looked almost regal. In buying the luggage in which to pack them, she couldn't have crammed them into the carry-on, even if she'd been willing to. In finding out what she could about the crew she would have on her ship. A last flurry of other shopping when one of the fitters reminded her that a captain would be expected to pay calls on civilians and would need a civilian wardrobe as well. Esme took Brun along for that. Her father left for home that second night. She was surprised at how she missed him in the few hours left before her own departure. Then Brun and Kate took her to the shuttle terminal, and after a last round of goodbyes, she joined the stream of travelers in uniform heading for the fleet shuttle access. This time, the ID booth recognized her at once. She had only a moment's claustrophobia from the memory of her earlier arrest before the light turned green. The guard at the gate saluted when she arrived at Rockhouse Major.
Welcome home, Lieutenant. Your transport to Sector 7 HQ leaves in 4 hours, sir.
Thanks, Sergeant.
Esme hoped that was enough time for luggage transfer. She didn't want to lose her new finery. Meanwhile, she could look Baron up in the fleet database, now that she had access again. When she did, she turned away from the display in confusion.
Copper Mountain? What is Baron doing on Copper Mountain?
Harless Thornbuckle eyed the gray-haired man across the table. Tall, trim, square-shouldered, erect, with a look on his face that Harless knew came from command of a ship in the regular space service. A ship now at the service of anyone who could hire it.
But why would you want to go to Cerealis, the first place they'd look?
They won't, because they aren't looking for me, and no family member is there.
Never mind that they would be looking for him as soon as they knew he'd slipped his surveillance cuff. That discovery was hours away, thanks to his dentist. If he could finish his business with this fellow, make that quick run back to Castle Rock and return, get off this damnable station quickly enough, it wouldn't be a problem. The messages on his comm unit at home should make it clear that he was actually headed for his own estates. Besides, it was none of his hireling's business.
You can cut off communications, can't you?
Yes, or control them, but it's an out-of-the-way system.
All the better, isn't it? Low population, high productivity, not on regular trade routes. It's known as a family seat, so why would anyone look there?
We'd need more information.
I can get that for you. But can you do it?
Probably, yes. But it will cost you.
That's not a problem. I have plenty of money.
Fine. And suppose you get us off this station.
Off?
I didn't bring my ships into the station. Someone might see them and tell Fleet. That would be bad.
We can hire a yacht.
Just like that?
I am seated family. Whatever else happens, they can't take that away. And I have more than ample funds to hire any yacht up here. What do you need?
Let me check what's listed. Get us the Lillian C. Passenger capacity's 15. Bare. We've got crew. If they won't lease it bare, ask to speak to Denny. And when you get Denny, say, little ships have big ears. That should take care of it.
He sat back, tucked the comm unit in his pocket, and nodded at Harless.
Now?
How fast did you want to leave?
All right.
Harless called All Systems, where his name got him past the first two levels of reception and onto a personal sales officer.
I need to lease a yacht. What's available?
The man began describing yachts, transmitting the data. Harless made disparaging comments until he mentioned the Lillian C.
That's not so bad.
He listened to descriptions of a few more yachts.
That Lillian yacht, that sounds like what I'm looking for. How soon can she be ready?
6 hours, Sir Thornbuckle, but obtaining a crew...
Never mind the crew. I'll take care of that.
Family retainers, I suppose?
Qualified crew.
We really prefer to have at least one All Systems...
If it's a matter of cost, I'm prepared to pay your crude rate.
Oh. Well then, how long do you need her for?
60 days. No, better make it 90. I've got to visit several systems. Burkholt, then Celeste. If I remember rightly, the transit time will eat up 40 days, and then there's my business on planet.
How about 90 with an option for another 90? You can contact any All Systems office to extend your lease. We have agents in both Burkholt and Celeste.
That will do very well. What are your provisioning options?
Well, there's the basic package, but for a gentleman of your rank, we usually recommend at least the gold level.
Fine, I'll be over shortly to sign and make the deposit. Put us down for the departure queue, would you?
Of course, Sir Thornbuckle.
Now it was Harless's turn to sit back and look at his new employee.
6 hours and she'll be ready.
Good. By the way, my name's Taylor. I'll go get the crew together. You get that information you said you could find and meet me at the All Systems office at 2100.
It occurred to Harless that his employee was giving him orders and very little information. Brunn turned away from the shuttle terminal.
Well, I'm glad she's back where she belongs, but we sure have a mess to deal with here. And I don't really have a clue where to start.
Oh, well, you might want to start by helping me finish up my mission so as I can get home. With that consulate out of the way and a new foreign minister, we ought to be able to get those trade restrictions lifted and those assets unfrozen, don't you think? And this would be a real smart time for the Familius to make nice to its neighbors.
You're leaving, too.
Well, hon, I can't stay here forever. And I figure I've given you folks about all the advice I can, without asking for a salary.
Oh, I'll miss you. But yes, we should be able to get your government's needs attended to. Though since my mother killed the former foreign minister, you might do better without my help.
Yeah, let's just see. I'll meet you for lunch, why don't I, and let you know how it went. The townhouse?
Fine.
Kate waved and turned away. Brunn started to offer her a ride, but realized that the ranger was more than capable of finding her own way. Brunn glanced aside to be sure her security detail was in place, and then walked tamely to her own transport. At the townhouse, she kicked off her shoes as she entered the small but comfortable library. It had been her father's. His father's, too, she presumed. Now it was hers. At least, when she was here alone. She sank into one of the big armchairs, propped her feet on the hassock, and closed her eyes. Brunn ignored the incoming call, closing her eyes a moment.
For me?
Yes, Sarah. Victor Barraclough.
Victor? What could he want? I'll take it in here.
It's on the secure line.
Which meant using the privacy booth in the hall. Brunn fitted herself into the booth, put her hands on the ID plate, and looked into the scan mask. When the light turned green, she sealed the unit.
Victor? It's Brunn. How may I help you?
Brunn? Steppen wants to meet with you.
The head of the Barraclough Sept. Her heart started pounding, and questions raced through her mind.
Where and when?
He would prefer that you come to his attorney's office. And is Cavill Mahoney well enough to come along?
I have a lunch meeting, but I'll contact Cavill and see. I'm assuming he wants to meet today.
If possible, this afternoon at 3. If not, tomorrow.
I see.
And it's family and sept business, which we would prefer to be kept private. I know you have that woman from the Lone Star Confederation with you, some kind of law officer?
A ranger, they call it. Yes, she was very helpful when Hollis was fighting Dad's will.
So I understood. If you believe her to be discreet, Steppen would not object to letting her know where you are, but not anyone else.
Fine, then.
Brunn called Kevil, now home from the rehab center, from the same booth, and waited while he made the secure connection.
What are you up to now?
Victor Barraclough. He called to tell me Stepan wants to see me, and you, if you're up to it, on family and sept business this afternoon or tomorrow afternoon.
That's very interesting. Have you been following the news the past couple of days?
No. We've been getting Esme back to Fleet and off to her new command. Why?
The Consulines are bruiting it about that your family colluded with the Benignity to arrange the deaths on Patchcock, Hobart's assassination, and Peter's death.
Oh my, that's ingenious. How do they think we did it?
Well, apparently Oscar Moraline came up with the idea that the Benignity spy in a Patchcock pharmaceutical facility was planted there by your family. To ruin the Moraline's reputation, you see.
But that's ridiculous.
Paranoid in high degree. Unfortunately, however, Atala, Oscar's daughter, must have told her father unflattering things about you from your school days together, because he's convinced that you all had a grudge against the Moralines.
Memories of schoolgirl pranks rose in Brunn's mind.
She was fairly poisonous, but I didn't do anything worse than she did.
Well, that's not how he heard it. He's almost got himself convinced that this spy was not only planted by your family, but that Atala was on the spy's trail and about to expose him when he killed her.
Otala couldn't have trailed a paint-dipped cat across a white carpet. She was impenetrably self-centered. Of course, so was I. We all were. Except maybe Raffaella. But Otala wasn't just spoiled and rich and selfish. She wasn't overbright, besides.
Whatever the facts, what people believe is something else. Oscar got a little of his influence back under Hobart, and he's making the most he can of Hobart's death. He's convinced that the Benignity ambassador is lying, that the Benignity wouldn't really have someone killed just because of their beliefs about rejuvenation. Besides, Hobart wasn't a rejuvenant.
So the Consulines are painting us black, our immediate family, or the whole sept?
The whole sept.
And I suppose Stepan wants me to be the sacrificial lamb, in council, in front of everyone.
I doubt it. Stepan respected and liked your father. He's very old, you know, and he's never rejuved. I suspect he wants you to do something, and we'd better find out what.
Can you make it this afternoon?
Of course. 3? I'll be there. And I would bet you, if you were a gambler, that if I call his attorneys right now, someone will ask me to lunch. And then we'll go back to their offices around 2, chatting about how to get my business back in shape. And I just might still be there at 3 when you arrive.
Oh, deviousness.
Yes. And if you think you and Stepan will be pulling up to the door at the same time, think again. 3 this afternoon gives him plenty of time to arrange staggered arrivals for everyone he wants to have come, and not much time for leaks. Look worried, Brun, when you arrive. Look like someone who's expecting a scolding or even to be denied a seat. And it wouldn't hurt if you called Buttons and asked what he thought of the Moraline rumor mill, without mentioning Stepan.
Oh, more deviousness. I can do that.
Shortly after that, Kate arrived for lunch, kicking off her high heels as she stepped onto the patterned carpet of the hall.
I don't see why you wear those things if they hurt your feet.
For the sheer pleasure of taking them off and wiggling my toes in this. I've almost got the foreign ministry to agree to cancel the trade embargo, and I have appointments with 2 other ministers this afternoon. When I get those assets unfrozen, then it's over and done, and I can take off for home, with maybe just a bit of sightseeing along the way.
Sightseeing?
Well, like I told that young man on the ship that brought me here, I wouldn't mind a bit seeing the famous sights of the Familias. When else am I gonna have the time?
What's on your list? You know it could take a year or more.
They discussed tourist destinations over lunch. Then Kate put her shoes on and headed out to do battle with the bureaucrats. Brun arrived at the offices of Sperling, Tacklin, DeVries, and Bolton with what she hoped was a worried scowl. She had considered, and discarded, the idea of a disguise, but she wore another conservative dress.
Ah, Sarah Miga. Please come through.
Brun stepped through to be met by a glossy young man whom she realized, after a moment, was George Mahoney in formal business attire, with an expression so different from his usual that he didn't look like himself. As he grinned, the old George reappeared.
Fooled you, didn't I? Passed my exams. I'm here to interview.
Brun almost asked if he weren't going to work with his father, but the thought occurred that that was probably the best excuse any of them had.
Dad had lunch with a senior partner today. They have an opening. He called and said to get myself over here. So, here I am. And I think they're checking out my willingness to do as I'm told by asking me to escort visitors.
How were the exams?
I did pretty well. Actually, I did very well. And Dad was pleased. And I think that's why he wangled a lunch invitation. Though he said Sir Sperling had been asking before if they could help.
Come tops in the exams?
As a matter of fact, not quite. You know that cousin of yours, Veronica?
Brun remembered the slightly gawky girl at the Hunt Ball long ago, when the Crown Prince had ridden a horse into the dining hall.
She came in first. I came in second. And? We're getting married. Hey, here you are, Sarah Meager, Sir Sperling's office.
George, why don't you go downstairs? I believe the library clerk has some files for you.
Sir Sperling, who looked to be about 60, led her into his spacious office. In the office were Kevil, looking far more comfortable now with his new arm, Victor, and Stepan Barraclough. Stepan stood and came to her. He was an old man, though not so old as Victor, and looked it, his face furrowed and sagging with age, showing the bones underneath, his eyes sunken beneath heavy lids.
Brun, my dear, how good to see you again. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. You're quite welcome.
You will have wondered why I asked you to come, and you must have heard what Oscar Moraline's come up with.
Yes, to both.
Good. Brun, I don't know if you've ever heard why I refused rejuvenation.
Brun shook her head.
It was the price Costan, my grandfather, demanded for ensuring that I would be in succession for the position I now hold. It was his opinion that in the transitional period, as the scope and effects of rejuvenation spread, the sept must have someone in the power structure who had not rejuvenated. Who would be a reality check for the rest, reminding them of the passage of time and the needs of the whole.
Long life for power. not both.
Exactly. And also the experience of longing for long life, and the experience of dealing with those who had it. At 20, I had no difficulty choosing power. At 40 or 50, moving up the power structure of our sept, I first felt the longing as my friends rejuvenated and regained their youth. My wife wanted me to rejuve. She had, and when I wouldn't join her, she left me. It was hard, then, to stick to the bargain I've made, but I am nothing if not stubborn. And besides, he'd extracted that same promise from one of my uncles, who is then the new head of our sept. So if I reneged, my uncle would have found someone else. And I was, as my grandfather had foreseen, good at the kind of work it takes to be a good head of the sept.
I chose long life, but then I always had too much temper to be a candidate for the job.
Ah, but you make a very good stalking horse, Victor. I can count on you to draw the enemy's fire and reveal their ambushes.
That's why he's so good at it, Brun. He always finds a way to flatter you into doing what he wants.
Not always. I never found Harless very cooperative and blessed Bunny for being firstborn. I know what you were bred for, Brun, but not entirely what you've made of it. I need your talents, my dear. I had hoped to wait another 10 years or so, but events turned against me. You are young, but you've been through an experience that would mature most people. I'm hoping it's matured you.
Brun began to have an inkling of where he was going, and the excitement of the possible challenge warred in her mind with the fear that she wasn't ready.
I hope so, too.
I need an heir, and I'm offering you the same bargain that was offered me.
Brun found she couldn't speak.
The government is at a crisis. Even without the Moraline accusations, the economic problems resulting from the rejuvenation issue and the threat from the Benignity would have brought it to the same crossroads. The woman who would have succeeded me first, Carlotta Bellinvo, developed intractable renal failure after the treatment for a routine infection. Only rejuvenation would save her life, and she was only 45. She opted to risk it, but despite auto transplants, she died last year. If I were paranoid, I'd suspect the Consulines of doing this by means of the drug she took for the original infection. But frankly, I think it was just one of those things.
Was that all? You had just one?
Not originally, no. But it's the combination of leadership talent and willingness to forego rejuvenation that makes such people hard to find. Back when I was young and repeatable rejuvenation was new, there were plenty of cautious people my age who didn't rejuve at 40 or 55. But that number has dwindled. Now many of the wealthy are doing their first rejuve at 30. Your own older sister and her husband, Brun, just rejuved and thought nothing of it. They're in their 30s.
Brun wondered if he knew that she had wanted to rejuve, to change her appearance and identity, to wipe herself out. Now that seemed a macabre idea, clearly the thought of someone mentally unbalanced.
So if I agree not to rejuve, you will support me for head of the sept? I thought it was elective.
It is elective, but like nearly all elections, it's somewhat rigged. And just agreeing not to rejuve is only the first step in the selection process. If you're going to say yes, please do so, so we can get on with the rest of it.
Yes, I will agree to that. A short life. And a merry one.
Good. That's the first step. I found it a good bargain, by the way. Hard to hold in the middle, but I have no regrets at this point. Now, I haven't had time to get to know you since your return, but I've had my feelers out. Victor, hand her the cube.
Brun took the data cube.
You'll want to view that in private. It's your complete dossier. If there's anything not on it, especially anything that could affect your political effectiveness, I need to know. How many Grand Council meetings have you been to now?
5.
Good. You're over the awe of taking part, I hope?
Oh, yes.
I'm going to ask you to address the Grand Council on behalf of our sept at the next session. That is, as you might expect, coming up very shortly. The Councilians are demanding it to discuss Pater's death. It is a critical session, and I'm hoping that you'll come as a startling surprise.
Brunn managed not to gulp audibly.
What would you say if you were going to speak now, knowing no more than you do?
Brunn gave Kevil a quick glance, but he was watching Stepan, not her. Ideas raced through her mind.
What's the priority? Defend the family and sept against the accusations of the Morlines? Tackle the subject of legal reform and its relation to rejuvenation? Attack the rejuvenants? No.
In a flash, she saw that what was needed now, at this moment, was a common goal, something to bring the almost warring families into alignment, as the sight of running prey would pull bickering hounds into a line of cooperation.
Sirs and ladies, whatever other problems face our realm, we have one clear priority. For to solve the difficult and intricate problems, we need time and security. And the one thing which most threatens our security at this time is the mutiny within our regular space service. First, let us give all support to the suppression of this mutiny, the maintenance of security to our population and our trade, so that we can have the time and peace we need to discuss the other issues.
Good. Excellent, in fact. You were right, Kevil. She has the instincts and she's learned to use them. You want to flesh that out, polish it, but I like the spirit of it. How will you deal with the questions about your family?
With the truth, sir. And then tell them they can tear me and eat me later, if they want. But right now they must support the loyalists in fleet.
Yes, as long as you have a fox for them to chase. And I'll admit the mutiny is a very laudable fox, which I hope we catch, cast, and tear before it gets to Earth.
Later, in the library at the townhouse, Brunn blanked the cube reader's screen, having just finished reading Stepan's dossier on her. She was more than a little astounded at the contents. That he could readily find out about many semi-public scrapes, the ones that had appeared in various news vid shows, didn't surprise her.
But how did he dig up that mess at school when I was 13? And how did he figure out that it wasn't my fault, even when my parents believed it was? And how did he know Brigdis Serkan had refused me?
Kate threw herself into a chair.
Whew! Only one more official appointment. Then I'm free! What happened to you, Brunn? You look like someone ran over you with the herd of longhorns.
Oh, old family stuff. Did you ever come across something that let you know exactly what someone thought about you when you were a kid?
You mean like old letters or school records or something? Yeah, I guess I know what you mean. Even if they say something nice, it's never the kind of nice you expected or wanted.
Exactly.
So, what'd you find out?
Brunn told her about the mess in school. Kate grinned at the memory, then looked at Brunn again.
Well, what do they expect with a lot of girls that age locked up together? Otala. Huh. Was that the same Otala Morline that Oscar Morline's going on about?
The very same, but I didn't do anything that bad back to her.
No, I wouldn't think that you would. But I hate to be self-serving about this, but what effect is all this gonna have on the stability of your government? It's not gonna do me much good to have things going well, go home, and then have it all come unraveled again. Rangers are supposed to settle a problem once and for all.
It's our problem, not yours, to solve. But I'm arguing for Esme's approach. First, we deal with the mutiny, get ourselves some secure breathing space, and then we can work on the rest. In the long run, we've got to make some big changes, as you've said, as a lot of people recognize. But in the short run, we need to get Fleet back on sound footing.
That sounds reasonable. Have you had your supper yet?
No. You?
Just a snack. But you're looking a bit peaked. We blondes need to keep our strength up for those roses in the cheeks. I could manage to keep you company in a snack.
Brunn shut off the cube reader and got up.
All right. Now that you mention it, it's odd that no one's asked me. not the staff's day off. And they knew I'd be in this evening.
At that, Kate's eyes narrowed.
Where's your security?
Outside the house, I assume. Why?
Weren't when I got here. Not visibly.
Brynn felt a chill run down her back. Here, in the family house, she had no weapon to hand. She hadn't thought she'd need one. Kate gave her a long look.
Well, never mind. Let's have dinner out somewhere. Didn't you tell me about a place Lady Cecilia liked?
Why not? This place is too quiet anyway.
Brynn felt prickles all over her skin as she stood up, stretched, fished around under the desk for her shoes. She slipped the cube from the cube reader and put it in her pocket. She looked at Kate.
Now what? An attack in the hall, outside the door?
I'm in the mood for fish. That lassafrin snail fish you people have. I wonder if we could import some eggs or larvae or whatever a snail fish has.
Oh, no fish for me. I'm thinking rabbit fillets stuffed with herbed cheese.
They were in the hall. Brynn could see the front door and lights spilling into the hall from the front rooms. No odd shadows. She glanced back toward the service door, the wide, carpeted hall with its umbrella stand where her father's walking stick still stood. Brynn slid it out of the stand as she passed without missing a stride, as if she always took a man's walking stick out to dinner. Nobody lunged at them as they walked past the open door of the study, the front room. They paused before the door. Kate's eyebrows went up, and she shrugged.
How cold was it out? Are you going to need a wrap?
I might. Your so-called spring is colder than ours, but you'd probably call it balmy.
She reached for the door of the cloakroom. Brynn held the walking stick poised. The door opened, and the interior light came on, revealing nothing more sinister than a rack of hangers, mostly empty. Her father's old smoking jacket, which she'd looked for at Appledale and not found. Her mother's moss-green cashmere scarf. A tweed jacket of her own, an assortment of raincoats, dark blue and tan and gray. Kate chose a dark blue raincoat and wrapped the green scarf around her throat. Brynn took another like it. Still nothing. She flicked off the lights in the front of the house, waited a moment for her eyes to adjust to the darkness, and opened the front door. Cool, damp air washed in. Kate moved past her, staying close to the entrance. Brynn left the door slightly ajar in case they needed to bolt back inside, though she didn't think that was a good idea anyway.
Leave it wide open and come on.
Brynn pushed the door open and followed Kate along the house wall to the corner. Outside, the distant streetlights gave enough glow that she could see rough shapes. A light in the study shone out and gilded the top of the hedge she had heard the gardener trimming that morning. At the back of the house, another bar of light lay dimly on the lawn.
Let's go.
They struck out across the lawn. Brynn had remembered to bring the lockout so the perimeter security, if whoever had removed her staff hadn't disabled it already, wouldn't start the alarms and let the bad guys know where they were.
Of course, if they have the right gear, none of the sneaking around will work.
She sidled through a row of camellia bushes, then peered through the shoulder-high evergreen hedge beyond. Nothing but the gleam of pavement reflecting distant streetlights. Not that she could see anything to either side. Brynn pulled the raincoat up over her head to keep the needly foliage from catching her hair and pushed the branches of one bush aside with the cane. Kate was right behind her. There they were on the sidewalk, with no obvious threat anywhere. Brynn jammed her hands in the pocket of the coat and found an old scarf, which she tied over her head as they walked along.
Oh, well, that was interesting. I think I'll report a house with an open front door when we get a little away from here.
I was thinking of calling the security agency and mentioning that their employees had disappeared.
Two strings to your bow. You gonna carry that cane all the way into town?
I think so. Everything else I might carry is upstairs in the bedroom.
As they came to a busier street, they joined a stream of pedestrians headed for a transit stop and paused in the sheltered kiosk where the public comm units were. Brynn called the security company, then Kevel, to report where she was so he wouldn't panic. They boarded a tram, got off at the next stop, dove down a subway entrance, and, three transfers and a call for reservations later, were ushered into the ladies' retiring room at Celeste. They grinned at each other in the mirrors, handed over the raincoats and scarves to the attendant, and strolled out to be seated in one of the bay window alcoves overlooking the stone garden. This early, the restaurant wasn't crowded.
You people go in for strange gardens. Ah, they do have Le Saffron snail fish.
Oh, drat. They don't have rabbit.
So what are you gonna have?
I don't know. My mouth was really set on rabbit. Lamb, maybe. Cantaloupe is just... Oh, it's just too.
Start with soup. So will I. We both need it.
They were most of the way through the soup when a stir near the entrance caught Bryn's attention. Someone was talking urgently to the Major D, trying to get past him.
She's my niece, dammit.
Uncle Harless was supposed to be under detention or surveillance or something. Bryn hadn't paid much attention beyond being assured he wouldn't bother her. Pending investigation of his felonious actions in the various family businesses and his attempt on Bunny's inheritance.
I've a right to see her. I'm worried.
At that, Kate turned around.
The wicked uncle returns?
Something like that.
A colored light had come on at their table, discreetly signaling that someone wanted to speak with her. Bryn pressed the response. Kate raised an eyebrow.
Might as well. He'll just make more of a scene if we don't. And he's not likely to try a physical assault here, in public.
Now the maitre d' was leading Harless over to their table.
Boone, I've been so worried.
Harless looked more flustered than worried to Bryn, but she didn't argue the point.
After all, your mother and I tried to call you, but no one answered. And when I went by, there were police all over the house.
Really? Why?
Well, they wouldn't say. Are you all right?
Fine. Is that all you wanted, or is there something else?
Look, Bryn, I know this may be a bad time, but I want to go to Cerealis.
Cerealis? Why on earth? You know the court upheld Dad's bequests.
Yes, I know, but there are things of mine there, and I want them.
I can have them sent to you.
I need to go there myself.
Bryn could see others giving them sidelong glances.
Is he drunk? I don't think that's a good idea. There's no one in the family in residence.
I'm in the family. It's as much my home as yours. It should be. It's not fair.
Harless, you would have had the same access you always had if you hadn't tried to cheat us. That wasn't fair.
Neither is making the daughter of a murderer the Barraclough heir.
Bryn could almost feel the tense fascination of the other diners. She wondered where he'd heard that.
Is that what this is about?
What did you do? Diddle the old man?
The maitre d' and one of the larger waiters started toward them.
Oh, what's the matter, Harless? Did you just give it away?
Bryn felt her face heating. Kate's taste in humor belonged in a barn, but managed to hold her neutral expression. When the maitre d' was near enough, she turned to him.
I believe my uncle is not feeling well. Perhaps you could help him to some assistance.
Of course, Sarah.
You'll regret this, spoiled, bratty, stupid little bitch!
The other diners applied themselves to their food with commendable delicacy until Harless had disappeared from the room.
Whew! I will say this about your uncle. He done let an occasion for stupidity pass him by.
I needed that, but I have to call someone, a secured call. Can I leave you a few minutes?
Of course! I will amuse myself by flirting with that handsome young fella who just walked in and is standing by the wall over there. Could it be our George?
Oh, I don't need to make the call.
You don't have to be so mysterious with me.
Actually, I do. Excuse me a moment.
Bryn walked across the room and stepped out into the foyer with George Mahoney.
I'm glad you're all right.
Things happened.
Yes, Dad's taken care of it.
Harless was here.
Here?
Yes, you must have just missed him. He was asked to leave.
Did you talk to him?
Yes. He wants to go to Cerealis.
Let me call Dad. Then, can I join you for dinner?
Of course. I'll tell Kate and snag a waiter.
When George exerted himself to be charming, he could be very charming indeed. Kate, who had only seen him worried about his father or being casual at Appledale, had not experienced the glossy splendor of George in full feather. Bryn sat back and watched them banter and flirt and chat, and she worked her way through her saddle of venison without saying much. The food revived her, and by the time they were ready for dessert, She was ready to ask questions.
The house staff?
All safe. Variously disposed of, but safe. Your security was less fortunate, but they're all alive. Stepan has assigned Barraclough senior security to you. The house will be safe tonight, but he recommends that you spend the night elsewhere. You can always stay with us, you know.
Do you know who or what?
Not for sure, but Harless's name was mentioned.
He started out saying he was worried about Brunn. Said he'd been by the house, seen the police. As if he thought something might have happened. Seemed put out that she was safe and unworried.
Nobody told me he'd been to the house. I'd have thought they'd hold him if he'd shown up. Where did he go?
I have no idea. All I know is he wants to go to Cerealis. And when I didn't agree that he could, he said I'd be sorry.
I think we need to call that in right now. With any luck, we can find him, but he could have caught the upshuttle already.
Oh, if we'd been there, if he'd had backup, Brunn could be dead and he could be on that shuttle.
Brunn eyed the pastry cart coming toward them.
Well, I'm alive. And I want something with chocolate all over it.
Gunnar was just getting ready to head up to the main restaurant block in this section of the station for dinner when his comm unit buzzed.
It's Commander Tavart. Those fingerprints and video were very interesting.
Oh? This isn't a secure link at this end, Commander.
Not a problem. Just wanted to tell you how glad I am you aren't heading out with that particular passenger. And to keep a close eye on your area in case he decides to retaliate for your inhospitality.
Believe me, I shall. We were going out to dinner, Basil and I, but we could stay aboard if you think that's wise.
No, dinner out sounds fine, as long as you have someone reliable aboard. If we should happen to meet, I presume you're still annoyed with Fleet for its ungenerous attitude towards informers?
Of course. Shall I snub you or you snub me?
Both a little cool, I'd say. Oh, and thanks for your information about Sweezer. She's turned up. She was visiting a private residence, and that's why we couldn't find her.
Gunnar had not considered that this interest might be real.
You mean you really...
Two strings to my bow and two arrows knocked. Though if I understand bows at all, that's not how it could work. But you grasp my meaning.
Gunnar thought of asking about Betharnia and her troop, but decided better not to complicate an already complicated situation.
Indeed. I'm taking my comm unit along if you need to contact me.
With a last warning to the ship's crew, he and Basil headed up to the main levels. Rockhouse always made him feel he was in the thick of things. Zenebra might be as crowded just before the trials, but that was all horse people, all one sort. Here it was the variety, the sense that everyone at one time or another might turn up on business. Shops, news kiosks with screens flickering and hard copies racked below, more shops, the bustle of the evening traffic, mostly well-dressed at this hour, the soberly dressed businessmen and women who were still working, the gaudily dressed young out for an evening. As a Tarakian captain, Gunnar now had a membership in the Captain's Guild. He had booked a table for himself and Basil. He'd been here before as a junior guest of his uncle's, but this was his first time in the door as a member in his own right.
Captain Tarakian, of course. We are always delighted to see captains of Tarakian and sons here. Please, follow me.
Then, Gunnar had been awed by the decor, unused to the style of the inner worlds of the Familius. Now, he could almost feel he belonged here. Once the first course was on the table, Basil leaned across.
You aren't going to leave here without talking to Bethia, are you?
How can I talk to her when she disappeared into the fleet side of the station and I've heard nothing?
You could ask. You could have asked that commander.
He came to ask about the Sweezer woman. Why would he know anything about Bethia?
Gunnar, she likes you, and you like her, I can tell.
You cannot. Last year you thought I was falling for that blonde.
I was hoping. I knew better. Truly, I did. But don't try to tell me Bethia doesn't stir you.
Gunnar leaned over his soup, the rising steam an excuse for the heat in his cheeks.
Don't be vulgar, Baz. Besides, if she wants to talk to me, she knows where I am. Anyway, she's an actress. Why would she be interested in a plain old ship captain?
She's ready to settle down, maybe.
I doubt it.
The soup lay heavy in Gunnar's stomach, and he wished dinner over already. Basil went on spooning his in. His appetite hadn't suffered. Gunnar flicked on his comm unit.
Captain, this is Bethia.
Gunnar's pulse raced.
I'm finished here. We're contacting agents to see about a booking. I know we need to get our equipment off your ship and into storage or something. Could I come talk to you about that and about settling up?
Don't worry. Actually, Basil and I are having dinner at the Captain's Guild. Would you like to join us?
I don't know if I... Yes, Captain, I'd like that. Where is it?
Gunnar gave her directions and looked up to find Basil grinning like a boy who had just pulled the prize ring out of the barrel.
What?
It was Bethia, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Bethia, and yes, he's coming over here to have dinner.
Gunnar signaled a waiter and explained that he had another guest coming.
You're grinning all over your face. Some of our competitors are going to think you just made a deal.
Let them.
Gunnar's appetite had returned with a rush. He could have eaten an entire cantaloupe. Bethia arrived a few minutes later, and Gunnar would have sworn every male in the place perked up. She knew it too, he saw, and enjoyed it. But her smile was for him alone when he seated her.
I didn't want to call you until they were completely through. And then Doogie started up, insisting that he knew just what we should do and how and when. I had to get them all back to the hotel and call two agents before he'd leave off.
Oh, that's all right. What will you have?
Bethia glanced at his plate.
That looks good. Cantaloupe?
Yes. Soup to start, clear or cream?
Cream. I need something soothing.
Gunnar ordered dinner for her and waited.
Go on, don't wait for me.
I'd rather. It's been one of those days and I don't need indigestion tonight.
Bethia looked at Basil, then back to Gunnar.
I wanted to thank you again. Both of you. I know it caused you trouble and worry, and perhaps your company will be angry.
It's all right.
I've been trying to think how to make it work for you. Make it pay.
Your presence, Sarah, was all we needed.
You are married, my fine young cockerel. Don't pretend to offer what you don't have. And I'm talking business here. I thought, Gunnar, you might want a share in the company.
In an acting company?
Yes. It wouldn't amount to much, most likely. But we've talked it over, and we're all willing to split off another share for you. We know what could have happened if you hadn't taken us in. And if miracles happened and we had a long run in some major theater?
Her soup arrived, saving Gunnar the need to answer. Basil, who had not slowed down, pushed his plate aside.
Gunnar, I'm going back to the ship. I'm just not comfortable with none of us aboard. My vote's to take the share, though, if it comes to that.
As transparent an excuse as any he'd heard, but he, too, thought having Basil aboard was a good idea. Gunnar toyed with his vegetables and watched Bethia covertly.
Bethia, would you ever consider settling down?
Settling down? You mean in one place? Gunnar, I'm talented, but not that talented.
No, I meant as with a family. Live in a house on a planet, raise children.
Gunnar, are you asking me to marry you?
I would if I thought it would do any good.
Gunnar, that has to be the most depressed proposal I ever got. But I don't want to give up travel. Someday I'll have to give up the stage, yes. As I said, I know the limits of my talent, and it won't survive my 40s. And though I'm a reasonably good manager, there's been grumbling in my company that I'm too old to have the lead roles. Doogie thinks you could run the company as well. And Lisa is sure she'd be a better village belle.
Oh, she's wrong. She looks like a village idiot and sounds like a goose with a bone in its throat.
Not quite that bad. But I'll agree, she's not as good as she thinks. Anyway, I'd like to have children. But stay in one place? No.
Bethia gave Gunnar another of those looks that had raised his hopes.
I confess, I've been selfish, Gunnar. Traveling on the Fortune was such fun, and I thought maybe trader captains took their wives along. I like you. We can laugh together, that's important. And you're honest and kind. But not even for you will I go sit in a house on a rotating mud ball.
Some captains take their wives along. I mean, it's not against the rules.
Many are fooled by glamour, but wives and husbands see behind the stage makeup.
I'm not in love with your stage makeup. I'm not some callow boy.
Then who are you in love with?
The woman who took in a fugitive when she didn't have a clue how she was going to get him out. The woman who sang and danced and stole my heart while she was scheming to evade the benignity. The woman who could act two parts and never scramble them. And who, in all those weeks, doubled up in bunk space, never said a cross word, was kind to Esme Suiza.
All right, all right. This is utterly crazy. I have had suitors...
Gunnar's heart pounded until he was sure it would fly out of his chest.
I'm sure you have.
I can't just...
But the look on her face said she could. And suddenly she opened to him like a rose in midsummer.
All right. Yes. I've been taken with you since I saw you sitting there beside Basil, sad and worried and tired. I told myself it was just a performer's pride to make you laugh, make you smile, make you think you wanted me. But it's ridiculous, you and me. We aren't the lad and lass in the story.
Gunnar pulled her to him gently and inexorably. He buried his face in her hair.
Oh, that's true. We're not that lad and lass. But we are this man and this woman. You are so beautiful.
Harless arrived at the All Systems dock 30 minutes late.
What happened?
A slight inconvenience. Let's go aboard and get out of here.
Our departure slot isn't for another hour.
Harless went aboard to find that the owner's suite was full of duffel and four men were asleep there.
What's this?
Taylor showed him to the smallest cabin, meant, Harless could see, for a cook or valet or something like that.
You're down here. My people need to be together.
But
don't worry, we'll get you to Cerealis.
Harless settled himself into the narrow bunk and wondered how far behind his pursuers were.
Can they find me in the next hour?
How long they might have sat there, to the amusement of other captains and the waiters, Gunnar was later unable to guess. But their time of bliss was interrupted by a waiter bearing a note.
Oh, drat! It's that fellow from Fleet who was looking for Esme. I thought they'd found her. I wonder what he wants now.
I should get back to the hotel. I'll have to tell the others and endure Doogie's lectures and Lisa's gloating.
She pushed back her chair. Gunnar stood up.
I don't want to rush you.
Yes, you do.
Bethia came around the table, and in full view of everyone, gave him a kiss that made his ears catch fire. Yes, he wanted to rush her straight back to his quarters on the ship.
I'm not a sweet little virgin, you know.
I should hope not. All right, go settle him and let me know when you want to come back.
He walked her to the foyer, aware that Tarakian and Son's newest captain had just furnished juicy gossip that would be all over the intership comms just as soon as those captains made it back to their ships. As Bethia left, Commander Tavard stepped out of an alcove.
Handsome woman?
Yes. We are getting married.
I thought she was that actress.
She was?
I see. Come outside with me, will you? We have a bit of acting to do ourselves.
Maybe you should have asked Bethia.
No, I think you'll do.